Welcome to the Martian Drive-In Podcast number 72. My name is Terry Frost, and again, it is Yucktober. So for the second of the two Yucktober podcasts, I'm looking at a couple of films which maybe aren't bad, but do have some yuckiness to them. The first one is the wonderful and crazy but beautifully titled movie from 1958, I Married a Monster from Outer Space, starring Gloria Talbot and Tom Tryon. Then we go to 1996 for one of Troma's best films, and that is, of course, Romeo and Juliet, written and directed by James Gunn, who later on went on to write Guardians of the Galaxy, amongst other things. So sit back, relax, I'll get the contact details out of the way, and we'll get this podcast started. The Martian Drive-In Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of science fiction, horror and fantasy movie appreciation. It doesn't matter what it is, it could be all the way from George Méliès through to Michael Bay, though I'm not likely to do Michael Bay. But feedback is important to me. So if you want to leave some feedback, you can leave it at cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U, at gmail.com. You can leave it at the Martian Drive-In Podcast website, marsdrivein.blogspot.com. The other thing you can do is go over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. So if you type in Paleo-Cinema Cafe into Facebook, you can go and leave some feedback there as well. Now, there are occasionally adult concepts in this podcast, so just keep that in mind as you listen, and sit back and enjoy the rest of the show. Hi, how is everybody? It's sunny here and warm, and I went out to a lovely brunch at a friend's place and caught up with a whole bunch of very cool people. And so I'm feeling very sanguine and relaxed and at peace with the world right now. So it's going to be a good podcast, obviously. I'm not going to talk about the stuff that I've watched lately because it's only yesterday that I recorded the last Paleo Cinema podcast. So I haven't really watched anything between then and now. The only thing that's really happened in that period of time is that the Irish-American actress Maureen O'Hara died. Maureen O'Hara I like for a lot of things. She did a whole bunch of movies. She was an attractive redhead, very conservative Catholic, but very attractive. Never a fantastic actress, but a great presence in movies, and always very forthright. She wasn't a kind of shrinking violet kind of character. And I liked her in movies. I did see her in a couple, an Arabian Nights movie, which also had Vincent Price in it. I'd have to look it up to remember what it was, but it was pretty cool anyway. But yeah, so that's basically all that's happened. But I do have a question. I was thinking about the movie The Fifth Element, and my mind tends to work in lateral ways at times. So you remember in The Fifth Element, you've got Leeloo and Corbin Dallas, played by Mila Jovovich, and Bruce Willis, have to get the four stones, the four other elements, from Diva Pava Laguna and on Flossed Paradise. Now, as you might remember, the Diva is that woman, the big blue one with the tentacles and things. And the idea originally, before things went really crazy and she got shot, the idea was for her to pass on the stones to Leeloo and Corbin and enable them to then manifest the fifth element and save the world from the evil and all that kind of shit. So here's my question. We know that they got the stones out of a hole in her abdomen when she was shot. So here, there's actually two questions. There's two parts to this question. First off, how did they get in there? And second off, were she not shot by the baddies, how was she going to give Corbin Dallas and Leeloo the stones? Now, my thinking is quite gynecological about this. How the stones got there and how she was going to retrieve them is kind of a little bit Bangkok nightclub ping pong ball kind of thinking there. But let me know what you think. I'm interested to try to figure out how she would have gotten the stones, and it would have been a very different movie had she done it that way. But anyway, that's the way my mind works on these things, and it does a bit of thinking about, really, does it? But moving right along from there, and I'm glad I put that mental image in your mind, the two movies I'm going to talk about for the second part of Yoktober are I Married a Monster from Outer Space from 1958 and Tromeo and Juliet, the wonderful trauma film, of course, based on Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, and a film which I much, much preferred to the Baz Luhrmann version with Leonardo DiCaprio and Claire Danes for fairly obvious reasons, the biggest of which, of course, is that it is a Baz Luhrmann film starring Leonardo DiCaprio and Claire Danes. But on to happier things, and I'm going to start talking about I Married a Monster from Outer Space, the first of the two films for this second Yoktober episode. The star, Tom Tryon's, an interesting actor. He was in Moon Pilot that I talked about in the last podcast, so I thought I'd keep a thematic continuity by having a second Tom Tryon genre film for Yoktober. And this one's pretty good because if there's an actor better suited to playing an alien jammed into a human body who doesn't know what an emotion is, then Tom Tryon's your go-to guy for this kind of thing. Much better writer than he ever was an actor. He was from a fairly wealthy family, and I think making this movie, he felt that he was slumming it somewhat, and who could blame him, really? $175,000 budget, done in black and white by kind of B unit of a studio. It's really not the kind of property that a rich scion of a wealthy family wants to take his family to see what he's been doing in Hollywood. Add to that the fact that the lead actress, Gloria Talbot, was suffering from a severe tooth abscess during filming of this movie. You can understand why it's as it is. And also, one of the things, and I'm not making light of anything here, so please don't think that I am, but this has got to be the first mainstream movie, at least, where, from a 21st century point of view, a woman is raped by a space alien. Now, I'm not making light of rape at all, but from our viewpoint, if you look into it a little bit deeply, this movie has some severely disturbing and yucky parts to it. But before I go into that particular wormhole, here's the trailer from I Married a Monster from Outer Space.
A beautiful, innocent girl on her honeymoon. Her passionate dreams of perfect romance turned into a living nightmare. For this sweetheart she married, the man she had loved, was merely the hollow shell for the invaders from outer space.
Bill!
Who would believe her? Who could put through the flesh-crawling terror of this unearthly marriage when anyone she turned to could be one of them? Could she touch the body of this masquerading alien who wanted to learn the secrets of human love?
The race has no women. It can't have children. It will die out.
Eventually we'll have children with you.
What kind of children?
All kind.
Was it true? Could space monsters mate with Earth women? See the startling answer in the shocker of them all.
So this is the movie. It's kind of in a semi-rural, middle-class white America that a lot of films from the 1950s use as a shorthand. There's a bucks night for a guy who's just about to be married, and his name is, rather generically, Bill Farrell. He's about to get married to Marge, played by Gloria Talbot. Bill, of course, is played by Tom Tryon. And he's having a bucks night in the local bar, which is a kind of an interesting thing to look at from our perspective, because the bucks night tends to manifest itself in this case as Bill and his friends, his male friends, sitting around in a bar making kind of passively aggressive, misogynistic statements about their wives and their girlfriends while knocking back copious amounts of alcohol. Now, I've been to a number of bucks nights. I'll be honest with you. It's a phenomenon not entirely unknown to me. And I haven't been to one that's been like that at all. My first bucks night was quite interesting, but I won't tell you about that just now. But nonetheless, bucks nights tend to be a little more raucous than sitting in a bar bitching and moaning about the women in your life. It's not really about that. Bucks Nights are male bonding things. They're about adventure. They're about maybe a little bit of lechery. The ones I went to had some lecherous content to them. I'll be honest with you about that. But these guys, they just seem to be kind of whiny little shits in a lot of ways, which is kind of a weird thing. So anyway, Bill leaves his friend saying, yeah, I've got to get married tomorrow. I've got to go home and get some sleep, blah, blah, blah. And so, of course, being pissed, they let him drive home by himself through country roads because it's the 1950s and they didn't have seat belts. And so you can drive drunk and nobody really gives a shit. Now, a side note to that, I was thinking about the way things used to be as far as drunk driving and lack of seatbelts was concerned just a week ago. Now, when I was a kid, one of the things, this is late 1960s maybe, one of the things in Australia was, and I was living in New South Wales, was in New South Wales every year, the annual road toll would get up around 1,200 people a year killed on the roads. And this is before seatbelts, before mandatory breath testing. And, you know, basically people drove around drunken and killed each other in great numbers. Now, I found out what the latest road tolls are, and they're averaging. This is after there's been kind of speed cameras and seat belts and breath testing and drug testing and all those other things that we have now. 250 on average per year. So they've more than quartered. One-fifth as many people die on the roads has died when I was young, when there were less people in Australia. So watching stuff like this, where this guy drives his way home on a country road, pissed as a newt, and you can't really, you know, I kind of looked at him with a whole, yeah, you deserve it, mate. You deserve to be taken over by aliens. You're just totally fucking irresponsible. So the irresponsible Bill is driving along the country road, sees someone laying on the road, and of course stops to render aid, even though he's probably too pissed to do anything useful. So he pulls up the car, gets out, walks around the car to the front, and there's no one there. Then suddenly a black fog comes out of nowhere and absorbs him, and he's taken over by the aliens. Too bad, Bill. I don't care. You're irresponsible. So, next we see Marge in her wedding dress, and her and Bill get married. And we, of course, being people who have heard the title of the movie, know that that's not really Bill. And you can tell because he doesn't have any facial expressions, though it is Tom Tryon. And even before he got taken out by aliens, there weren't a lot of facial expressions happening anyway. So they get married and they drive off into the night, and they nearly have a car accident then. They don't have a car accident when Bill's driving by himself, pissed. But they have a car accident almost, and another car almost hits them while they're driving along the country road because Bill's been driving in the dark without his headlights on because he can see, because alien. So we know that Bill, A, is irresponsible, and B, is an alien, and C, can see in the dark. So we cut to a year later, and Marge is writing a letter to somebody saying, it's really horrible, Bill's cold and distant, and we haven't had I haven't got pregnant yet, even though we've been bonking, and this is a bad thing, and I'm writing you a letter to tell you how miserable I am. And Bill, of course, is, in a weird sense, a perfect husband because he's not going out drinking with his mates anymore. His friends just go and don't drink very much. But because alien Bill is shooting blanks, Marge is miserable and she goes and sees the doctor. The doctor says, no, no, there's nothing wrong with your plumbing. Get Bill to come in because there's nothing wrong with you. And so there's a certain tension between the two based on the fact that she's basically on a nightly basis being raped by an alien. And it is rape because it's non-consensual. She thinks he's somebody else, as we know from people who sneak into people's bedrooms and have sex with them. This is considered rape in our society. But in the world of the movie, her biggest concern is that she's not getting pregnant. And even when she does find out he's an alien, there isn't really that concept in her that she's being filled with alien jism for a year. It's really kind of because this is the 1950s and things weren't thought about like that, the kind of natural thoughts that you'd have in this kind of situation don't really manifest it. And the alien eventually kind of admits that, yes, he has feelings for her. And as that trailer at the start says, eventually, for some reason, they'll keep trying until they get it right and be able to impregnate women and make alien babies, because here's what happened on their world. And what happened on their world is that the sun went nova and they escaped in a fleet of spaceships. But because the women weren't as sturdy and robust as the men, and we can look into the gender politics of that, all of the women died. So the men just kept going and decided to try to find a planet where they could knock up females and have babies. Now, as a survival strategy, I'm not sure that this is the best one. What I'd be doing is really hitting the science labs and seeing what we can do about that in other ways, but not these guys. They just decide, well, we're going to go out and we're going to see what we can knock up, even if the women don't have tentacles all over their face and glow in the dark like our women did. We're going to come to this planet Earth and just see what we can do about stooping our civilization back into existence. Now, that's a pretty fucked up way of going about things, if you ask me. So, as Marge has her suspicions about her husband, and we see that he's an alien because when the strobing effect of lightning strikes him, you can see an overlay of alien face on his face. Good thing they didn't have discos in those days, because half the guys in the discos would be strobing-faced aliens, and things wouldn't go well. So she goes to the police. She goes to one of the cops, who is actually her godfather, who pats her on the head and goes, there, everything's okay. And, of course, he's one of the aliens as well. Meanwhile, one of Marge's friends is engaged to one of the guys who's been taken over by aliens, and Marge begs her to cancel her marriage. And, things are not going particularly well, and people start dying en masse. There's a really weird scene, and this is one of my bugbears in movies, because I know a little bit about this now. I really hate seeing movies where somebody has a revolver with a silencer on it. For a start, silencers don't work the best. They're not really a functional and useful technology in most circumstances, because they are still pretty noisy. That's the first thing. The second thing is, because of the way that the explosive gases leave a revolver, you can't really use a noise suppressor on it, because it just simply won't work. But nonetheless, if you look at any number of movies, they've got revolvers with silencers on them. And that movie totally loses any credibility for me when that happens. And this is definitely one of those movies. Lots of people start dying. They get shot by the aliens. A bar girl gets zapped with a ray gun. A dog gets killed in the basement because Bill's been given a dog by Marge, and the dog doesn't like her, so he chokes it to death, and then says, "Oh, sorry, its leg got caught around its neck and it died." So aliens are bad too, because they don't like dogs. One of the aliens has an accident while swimming, and is given oxygen by a medical team, and the oxygen kills him because the aliens don't breathe oxygen. I'm not sure what they're breathing. Whether they do one of those stupid things where they say, no, they breathe the nitrogen in our atmosphere. Nitrogen, being an inert gas, really isn't suitable for metabolic purposes. But, this alien dies because he's force-fed oxygen. And nobody bothers to do an autopsy and cut him open and see that there's an alien inside. None of that kind of stuff goes on for some odd and crazy reason. Now, this movie's fairly low budget too, so the alien spaceship is kind of small. It's almost like an alien bungalow rather than a spaceship. And then, of course, because this is the sort of movie it is, the alien falls in love with Marge, who seems to have no real virtue as a woman, because she's kind of nervous and edgy and she doesn't know what's happening. And nonetheless, for some reason, aliens find this particular series of character traits to be attractive, and Alien Bill falls in love with Marge, but Marge says, no, you're an alien, fuck off, pretty much. So eventually Marge convinces a doctor that the aliens are real and that they're all shooting blanks. And so the doctor decides he's going to get a posse together to hunt down the aliens with hunting dogs and shotguns, because hunting dogs and shotguns will always defeat an interstellar civilization that has ray guns. And so he goes, where am I going to get people I know aren't aliens? So what they do is they go to the maternity ward and get all of the fathers of kids who had just been born, because they know that those guys are real humans, because real humans can knock up women. Now, nobody stops to think that maybe they were taken over by aliens after they inseminated their wives. Nobody kind of, doesn't occur to them in the world of this movie, because it's that kind of movie. And so a whole bunch of hunters with hound dogs go out, and the world is saved, and the aliens decide, no, we're not going to Earth because they're just too much bother, and they have hound dogs and shotguns, and we can't very easily knock up their women, even though we were willing to keep trying until we did. And so the aliens go off to another planet, and Bill and the other men who have been hung up on wires in the alien spaceship all this time get rescued, and everything goes back to normal, except for the fact that Marge is traumatized by the fact that, A, she'd never actually marry Bill because she married the alien, and B, she's got a husband now who has the same face as the slimy alien bastard who'd been having non-consensual sex with her for a year. But everything is going to be okay, and things will go on, and the aliens will move on and try to do all of this again to some other poor bloody alien race somewhere out there in the universe. And this is why this movie is a part of Yucktober, because the sexual politics in this film is really repugnant. These guys are traveling through the universe basically having non-consensual sex with alien women in order to save their civilization, rather than doing the hard yards in a science lab, learning a little bit about cloning, getting their shit together, and taking responsibility for their own actions. These guys are basically ISIS in space, and they really need to take a good, long, hard look at themselves and just stop doing this. And that's why the DVD of this movie only cost me $5, because it's a repugnant film from a sexual politics viewpoint. It's got some very not very good acting in it. It is basically a perfect film for Yucktober. It really does have a lot of ick to it. Now, my mother realized this. Now, I first saw this movie on TV late at night when I was sitting up with my mum. And as a lot of people know, I had a very kind of difficult childhood. And my mother was assaulted a number of times by my father, both physically and sexually. And she and I watched this film. We sat up late and watched it. And she really empathized with Marge. She understood that, yeah, men are bastards, and particularly alien men are bastards, but men are bastards in general. And yeah, she kind of got totally on board with the concept that guys would do anything to get laid, and the guys were repugnant for that reason. And she found it quite humorous as well. She wasn't kind of traumatized by the movie, but she saw the humor in it and saw that, yeah, these guys are acting like just like guys, really. That's the whole thing about the aliens in this movie. They don't act too much differently from human guys. They go out to get what they want, and they get it. They're emotionally distant. They're repugnant. They don't consider the other party particularly. I mean, there's a lot here with the aliens in I Married a Monster from Outer Space, which makes them not too different from really bad human men. And maybe that's the point. Maybe that's what the movie's about. Maybe it's not the threat to the good 1950s nuclear family kind of thing, but actually the threat of a mirror being held up to male behavior. And there's also the vilification of people who can't have children as well. A marriage isn't seen completely in this movie without children. So the fact that Marge and her guy, even though he isn't actually her guy, he's alien Bill, not being able to have children is seen as a serious impediment to living their life together. And it's kind of almost, if it happened these days, it'd be looked at in a much more serious light and a much more seen as a judgmental thing by the fact that that kind of reproductive imperative can't occur in this case. Now, leaving aside the fact that the guy's an alien, she doesn't know he's an alien, and all of the sex is non-consensual, her big issue as she discovers these things isn't the fact that essentially she's been raped. And rape is a theme that has been serious in movies well before this one. But for the purposes of a cheap B-grade science fiction movie, they didn't really address any of those issues, and it wasn't something that was on their conceptual radar at the time. Sexual politics and the politics of consent weren't really big themes for genre films. And were this movie to be remade, and it was remade a number of years ago as a TV movie, but done slightly tongue-in-cheek, these days it would be seen as a much more transgressive thing for the aliens to act the way they did. But at the time, the biggest issue seemed to be, my husband's cold and distant, and we can't have children. And that's kind of, from our viewpoint here in the 21st century, when we're so much better, fucked up. Now, having said that about I Married a Monster from Outer Space, I'm now going to play a tune to do a little bit of a segue between this and the next movie. And I picked a song that demonstrates the fucked up sexual politics of the 1950s in Western society, and it is the Four Aces with the theme from another movie from that period, A Woman's World. And cringe as you listen to these lyrics.
Woman's world, it's a woman's world when she's in love. It's a woman's world when she's in love. It's a woman's world. His kiss can make her glow. That's what makes it so. It's a woman's world. It's a woman's world. Stars dance above. It's a lovely world. His footstep at the door just proves it more and more. Ambitions, all the ups and downs she'll gladly share. She'll give her all without conditions. When he looks around, she'll be there. It's a woman's world. Ask any man, it's a woman's world. And he's so glad it is. For when it's hers, it's his. It's a woman's world, but only because it's his. It's a woman's world. Ask any man. It's a woman's world,
and he's so glad that it is.
For when it's hers, it's his. It's a woman's world, but only because it's his.
Two more things about I Married a Monster from Outer Space. First one is there's a nice little effect where the aliens die and turn into something that looks like jelly with pineapple chunks in it. So that bit I like. And the bartender in the bar scenes in this movie is a very important gentleman from the history of entertainment. And that is Slapsy Maxie Rosenblum, who was middleweight champion in the 1930s and went on to have a career as a character actor to a certain extent. But the important thing about him is nothing to do with movies. It's to do with his nightclub in Los Angeles, Slapsy Maxie's, in the 1950s. It was the very first comedy club in the world. And Slapsy Maxies was the kind of prototype and the template from which all comedy clubs subsequent to it evolved. And so Slapsy Maxie Rosenblum is an important figure for that reason. The whole comedy scene, the 21st century phenomenon of comedians coming out of comedy clubs and going into movies and going into TV and doing all sorts of other things, and indeed going into podcasting, all kind of evolved from that one man that you see in the bar in this particular movie. So all credit to Slapsy Maxie Rosenblum. The reason they call him Slapsy Maxie was he had a kind of slapping, punching style as a middleweight, but it did seem to do him pretty much good because he ended up being the world champion. So that's about it. Now, on to something a little more fun, but very much more sanguine and transgressive, and that is the 1996 Troma adaptation of Romeo and Juliet, Tromeo and Juliet.
Two households, different as dried plums and pears, in fair Manhattan, where we lay our scene. Two homes adrift in hate for 20 years, a score, awash in sin for long deprived of dreams. Once long ago they planted seeds of hate, which bloomed to constant battles for revenge. Soon murder was the awful commonplace, and everything once real seemed like pretend. Deep within this storm, a love into us sparked, spawned in a box of glass one star-crossed night. Now if they thought it hard to live within the dark, let's see how many fall beneath love's light. Ah, yes, the splice of their unholy vice and the firmest grip of their parents' rage. It could only ever end by one father and his apt demise, which is now the 2 hours' traffic of our stage. Star-crossed lovers both, ignore your elder's trivial ploys. They hold no trace of passion's truer joys. Instead of justice, do now howl your caterwaul. Your deepest love will baffle reason's gall. All this, if you with patient eyes attend, we'll see what devils broke or toil shall mend.
That, of course, was Lemmy Kilminster from Motorhead, a band about which I know fuck all, really. As the narrator in the 1996 Troma film, Romeo and Juliet, directed and written by James Gunn, who we know for things like Guardians of the Galaxy and Super and Slither and a bunch of other films. He started out as a Troma guy and arguably the most successful alumnus of that particular studio that there is at the moment. I've got a lot of time for James Gunn. He's very good at using social media. He seems very approachable online. I've actually had Facebook conversations with the man, and he does seem to engage his fans in a way that was probably educated by the way that Troma, the studio, approached social media from day one. They were really big on getting to fan conventions and film festivals and engaging with their fans and doing all sorts of things like that. And it's something that Gunn has carried on into his incredible success these days. I've got a lot of time for Troma. The films are schlocky and transgressive and sexist and kind of nasty and gory in a comic way, but Lloyd Kaufman, the guy who runs Troma, is a very intelligent and very savvy man. He likes quality film. If you read in either of his books, he really does know film well, and he knows quality film, but he's found that for his purposes and for his business model, making cheap, crazy movies was definitely the way to go, and he's had great success in doing that and has built up an enormous fan base. And the inspiredness of getting someone with the cultural cachet of Lemmy to do the narration in iambic pentameter for a Troma adaptation of Romeo and Juliet is really, it has that kind of gonzo aptness that you've got to kind of love and admire in a lot of ways. Now, Lemmy isn't the best narrator you're ever going to get. He's nothing to Derek Jacobi narrating Henry V, you know, Oh for a Muse of Fire and all of that kind of thing. But he's got a certain kind of, as I said, cultural cachet. He's got a certain grassroots look, and he's got very much that Troma aesthetic about him. He did appear in a couple of other Troma films. He was in one of the Toxic Avengers sequels, Citizen Toxie, and also in Terra Firma, which is another one of Troma's films. And Troma films are an acquired taste. They're very much an acquired taste. But if you acquired it, you can kind of go along with it. They're, in a sense, relics of the VHS era to a big extent. I've got a number of Troma films. I don't watch them all the time. I don't think that they're in any way as good as The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, but I've got a fondness for them. And I like the fact that Troma and Lloyd Kaufman have kind of kick-started that grassroots grungy film movement that a lot of people have now been able to access as the technologies of making film. Everybody's got a movie camera in their pocket these days, literally. Troma is overall a force for good in cinema, even though the kind of films they make aren't the kind of films that a lot of cinema goers are going to enjoy. And Kaufman has written a book about making low-budget cinema. I've got it up here somewhere. I can't at the moment recall the title of it or see it amongst the menagerie of toys, playing cards, books, signs, and other debris I've got up on the shelves. But yeah, he basically does tell you how to make a low-budget film in one of his books. Okay, I've gone and found the book now because I couldn't not do it. It's called All I Need to Know About Filmmaking I Learned from the Toxic Avenger by Lloyd Kaufman and James Gunn, with an introduction by Roger Corman. And it's a nice read too. It's an amusing and interesting read, and it's got a lot of useful information for people who want to get in at the grassroots of making particularly exploitation movies. A number of famous people have appeared in Troma films. Kevin Costner was in Sizzle Beach, USA. Marissa Tomei was in The Toxic Avenger. Billy Bob Thornton was in Chopper Chicks in Zombie Town. Samuel L. Jackson was in Death by Temptation. Vincent D'Onofrio was in The First Turn On. So basically, Troma does have a kind of pedigree there of encouraging and blatantly exploiting talented people, and this movie is no exception. The cast are pretty much unknowns, with a couple of exceptions. Sean Gunn, the brother of James Gunn, is in there playing one of the Capulets, and he kind of has quite a nasty ending, his head colliding at high speed with a fire hydrant. But Sean Gunn is also one of Yondu's henchmen in Guardians of the Galaxy as well, so you'll see him in there. Now, the star-crossed lovers in the movie are played by quite a sweet couple of actors who kind of do an interesting job of it. Jane Jensen playing Juliet and Will Keegan playing Tromeo. And even though they're asked to do a whole bunch of transgressive and fun things, there is a kind of sweetness about the relationship between them, which it's slightly surprising. They could have gone total gross out, but nonetheless, the passion of the young lovers does very much show in this one. And for a movie which has a lot of tits and ass in it, it's overwhelmingly not sexist, which is a little bit of a surprise. Juliet does use a phone sex line off her own bat, so she's obviously got control of her own sexuality. Tromeo has an ex-girlfriend who treats him badly, and he doesn't particularly go ballistic about it, but he kind of is disappointed and sad by it, but he's not the kind of guy who would take things into his own hands as far as his ex-girlfriend betraying him. You've got Juliet's father is a monster, and Tromeo's father is kind of a little bit ineffectual. He's a drunk and sleeps most of the time. You've got a weird ex-boyfriend of Juliet's called London Arbuckle, played by Steve Gibson, who works in an abattoir and is pretty fucked up. And all the usual things. You've got Tyrone and Benny and Montague. One of the characters is called Montague because the family name is Q rather than Montague in the film. And it's just got a kind of energy and a passion and a bit of fun, even though it is very raw. The thing's well lit. The actors are better than average for a trauma film, which I kind of like as well. And it's got the usual over-the-top stuff. There's a couple of dream sequences that Juliet has, which are kind of monstrous, one of which includes a monster penis. The other one includes her being pregnant and giving birth to popcorn and a bunch of rats. It is a trauma film after all. But there's nothing in here that any, goes anywhere near body horror or anything like that. There's a kind of over-the-top 1990s feel about the film, which is not totally dissimilar to the early Peter Jackson films, which were, as we recall, before he found CGI, transgressive, rude, incredibly gory, incredibly ugly, with lots of monsters and a low-budget style to them. This is very much a part of that, and it's really cool for that. There is a scene of Romeo and Juliet bonking next to the lions in the New York Public Library, outside the New York Public Library, which is kind of cool, and shows that they weren't scared to do a bit of guerrilla filmmaking. Now, the movie ostensibly was also directed by Lloyd Kaufman, but from what we've learned since then, Kaufman did some of the stuff, but most of the work was actually done by James Gunn. James Gunn actually appears in the film as a family man driving a car, which then has an enormous car accident with a flip. Now, this car accident, you see, of James Gunn and his family in the car, is a car crash sequence that is used in any number of trauma films. They did it once, and Lloyd Kaufman wasn't reluctant to use it as a feature in a number of different trauma productions, including this one. It's almost kind of like a motif through trauma films. You do get a few other cameos in there. Sergeant Kabuki Man, NYPD, turns up, and the Toxic Avenger also turns up. They're both in a dance club sequence, because in Tromaville you are going to see the Toxic Avenger and Sergeant Kabuki Man turn up in disco. I really should re-watch the Toxic Avenger movies when I'm in the right mood for them. They're a bit of fun too. In fact, seeing this film really makes me want to go back and revisit some of those things. I've got them on the shelves here, so I might as well use them and go and have a look at them again. By the way, I've got to thank the Facebook group Mind, because they're the ones who suggested that I do a trauma film for the second part of Yucktober. And that really has helped with this. In fact, I'm going to read you the list of movies that people suggested that I do for Yucktober, and it's quite useful and good, and it shows the kind of sick and interesting people that I know. Okay, let's see. Grant Watson suggested Battlefield Earth, Pluto Nash, and Transformers Age of Extinction. So Pluto Nash may be on a future podcast. Here we go. We also had Dungeons and Dragons, a movie that was suggested by Grant. Now, I've tried to find the other post, because I posted this in a couple of different places on Facebook. And, of course, Facebook seems to have swallowed whole one of the two posts I did about this. So there were a whole bunch of other suggestions. I'm going to try to dig them out later and add them to the list, because there are some movies that actually might be worth checking out and having some fun with. Tim Leiby also sent me a Facebook message saying he's going to write a long post to me on why I'm wrong about Zardoz. And yeah, that's fine too. He can do that, and I'd be more than happy to put it up on the podcast and on the page as well. Yeah, a lot of people get defensive about that. And speaking of defensive, there was a lot of kerfuffle on my Facebook post, and on some other people's as well, about the new Star Wars trailer. And a lot of people went squee and did all the usual things. It was either squeeing about that or squeeing about Back to the Future, another movie series for which I have very little time, but because it's too middle-of-the-road white bread for my taste. But, yeah, the Star Wars trailer came out, and everybody went squee. And I have a number of things for this thing. I hope it's as good as people want it to be, for a start. It's not my cup of tea, and I don't like Star Wars, as we all well know. But I hope the movie is good enough to keep people happy. The other thing is, I hope it doesn't kill the career of Oscar Isaac, an actor who I have a great deal of time for. I've seen him now in Inside Llewyn Davis. I've heard him talk on the Nerdist podcast, and he seems to be quite a cool guy. And, of course, I have seen him in Ex Machina, And Oscar Isaac definitely got chops as an actor. I've got a lot of admiration for the way he does his stuff. And he's going to be the big bad also in the next X-Men movie, X-Men Apocalypse. So his career is skyrocketing, and I just hope he doesn't get locked into a genre niche where he can't do fine work, because I really like his stuff, and I think that his career is going to go gangbusters should he wish it to. But here's one thing I will say about the Star Wars trailer, though, is I've kind of compared and contrasted it to other big blockbuster trailers that have come up lately. And I compared it to things like the Spectre trailer, James Bond film, and again, not the same genre, but still a pop cultural phenomenon. And also with the kind of trailers that Marvel is putting up for not only their movies, but TV series, things like Jessica Jones, which I'm looking forward to coming up on Netflix. Contrasting that with the Star Wars trailer, and the Star Wars trailer seemed to be two things to me, and yes, I don't have an unbiased eye when this is concerned, I'll be honest about that. But the two things that it seems to be about were, first off, fan squee. It was all about the nostalgia for 1977 and for the characters that we knew in 1977. There's a lot of that there. And it's about the merch. It's about the toys. Because Star Wars overwhelmingly is a machine for selling merchandise. And it's useful to remember that in some ways. And the other thing, too, is one of the flaws that I found in the very first Star Wars movies, and ever since then, is it's about striking visuals. Now, just keep that in mind. Striking visuals, nostalgia for 1977, and the toys. And if you contrast it with, say, a Marvel thing, particularly something intriguing like Jessica Jones, where it's about character, it's about the menace to that character. You see the trailer, you know what the big bad is going to be. You know that things are going to get dark and serious, and it's going to be a genre ride unlike any other you've had before. You've got the villain played by David Tennant, which is a nod to the fans, but he's playing a very different character to any we've seen him in before. You've got the characters of Jessica Jones and Luke Cage in there, and some other ancillary characters look quite interesting. It's the hook that grabs you with a trailer like that, or with a lot of the Marvel trailers, is here's the big bad. The big bad seems overwhelming. How are these characters that we like going to overwhelm it? And you know, how are they going to survive and persevere in the face of that? That's a very different dynamic in a movie than the kind of three-pronged attack that the Star Wars trailer was, which was merch, nostalgia, pretty visuals. I think that there's a wide gulf between the two there, and I find it an intriguing phenomenon. I find that I'm happy being on the side of that gap that I am, which is I like things where I like the characters, I like the depth of the characters. The visuals are okay, but I still want to see where the story goes, and story above all else is crucial for me enjoying a genre film. I can't just go on nostalgia and pretty visuals. And that's one of the reasons why I'm not particularly enthusiastic about it. As I said, I'm happy. I hope it is a better film than I suspect it will be for the fans. But I'm not optimistic about it. And yes, if I'm proved wrong, big deal. I don't have a dog in this fight particularly. But it's interesting to contrast the pop culture phenomena and the way that their trailers present their product. So I'm not going to really talk much else about Romeo and Juliet. If you haven't seen it in a while, definitely see it. It is transgressive. It is a lot of fun. And it is kind of semi-professional filmmaking in a sense. It's people learning their art, using a lot of amateur actors, using a lot of quite gruesome but ropey special effects, which is part of the charm, of course. And I like the fact that they actually went with a subject like Romeo and Juliet and learned the subject well. Part of the script that James Gunn did for Romeo and Juliet it's great that he actually went and read the whole story rather than just taking the high notes that we all know from cultural context. The movie is true in a kind of weird way to the original source material, and that's an admirable thing. That's something that I like, and it's something that all credit to James Gunn for doing that. Even though the audience, of course, isn't one that's knowledgeable about the Bard, you can still enjoy the story. You can show the universality of Shakespeare's tales. And even in the context of a weird exploitation film with magic spells that turn women into cow monsters and dreams of giant mutant penises and craziness and body horror done as comedy. Yet the story still shines through, and we still like the ingenues falling in love in spite of their families and all that kind of stuff. It really kind of, and there is of course a very trauma twist at the end of that part as well, which make things kind of sick and interesting and funny all at once. But that's about it for this time around. I'm not going to talk too much about anything else. I'm not sure what I'm going to do next time, but I hope I can find some good stuff. I'm fairly confident. I've done this one or two times before. In the meantime, enjoy your movie watching. Keep watching the skies. Look after yourselves. Look after the people you love. Look after the people you don't have to be nice to, which is another big one that I'm learning more and more about as time goes on. And I'll be back in 2 weeks with another Martian Driving podcast, in a week with another Paleo Cinema podcast. I will catch you guys later. In the meantime, of course, support the Patreon campaign. Send me feedback via either Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook or via email. Yeah, I know email is old school, but give it a go. At cultguru@gmail.com, cult with a K. And I'll be back, as I said. And in the meantime, here, of course, are the credits, acknowledging and appreciating those people who have supported the podcast through the Patreon campaign. Credits done in the style of movie credits. Catch you later, guys. And here are the credits for the Patreon subscribers to the podcast in the style of movie credits. I'd like to thank Tom the Focus Puller, Sarah the Special Effects Technician, Ian the Caterer, Grant the Technicolor Consultant, Claire the Script Doctor, Gary the Prop Master, Morris the Musical Director, Jan the Dialect Coach, Armin the Key Grip, Matt the Rattlesnake Wrangler, Elaine our Scientific Advisor, Julia our Casting Director, Chris our Camera Operator, Christopher our Gaffer, Miss Jane our Wardrobe Mistress, Tansy the Foley Artist, Alyssa our Location Scout, Mark our Second Unit Director, Paul our Special Makeup Effects Director, Tammy the Donut Wrangler, Tim the New York Unit Director, and Rabbi Steve our Spiritual Advisor. We also have Paul, who does the special makeup effects, and Kathleen, who has yet to have a job in the credits, and Eric of course is the set security lead. So thank you to everybody who supports the podcast and to the people who listen to it. If you want to support the podcast with some micropayments, please go to patreon.com/paleocinema, and I'll catch all of you next time.